This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. This past week's elections were the last in North Carolina before new voter laws take effect. The U.S. Department of Justice is suing the state for its voter ID law. Proponents say the legislation is necessary to ensure the integrity of the system. Opponents say the law is discriminatory and will have a chilling effect on many voters. Joining us now is Bob Hall, Executive Director of Democracy North Carolina. Welcome back, Bob. Good to have you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also with us, Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at the John Locke Foundation. Good to have you back, Becky.
Thank you.
Bob, this past week we had elections across the country. Some other states have laws similar to the ones we just passed in North Carolina. Ours is not in effect. Some of theirs are. Can we tell anything about the turnout or the effect they had?
Well, it was interesting in Texas. This is the first time they've implemented their and they have a law that is pretty rigid, like ours. It says that if your name doesn't match on the rolls, your ID name and the registration rolls don't match up, you don't get to vote unless they're substantially similar. And in that case, you can vote an affidavit ballot. But if they're not even substantially similar, you might get turned away and have to come back and show a correct ID. But there were a number of people, including the attorney general, who had promoted the bill. The Republican had some trouble with it. The former Speaker of the House, Jim Wright.
Jim Wright couldn't vote in Texas?
I know. It was pretty funny. Some legislators, a judge. I mean, those are the prominent people, I'm sure, others. But, it was good that they had that backup provision so that you could vote an affidavit ballot. We don't have that in North Carolina. Our ID bill is not in the mainstream among ID bills across the country. We have probably one of the two or three most strict bills because it says that if you don't have one of these three or four IDs, you can vote a provisional ballot, but it won't count unless you come back. Most states that have a photo ID requirement still say that if you don't have it or you forgot it, you can vote an affidavit ballot. You can swear that you are who you are. You can give an identifying number like the last four of your social, and that can be verified, and then your ballot will count.
What about that, Becky? Is that going to be a problem?
Well, we'll see. One thing about this voter ID law in North Carolina, it doesn't go into effect until 2016. So we've got some time to work through this. As far as confusion about what kind of identification is needed and those other questions, they're going to have sort of a trial run, if you will, during the 2014 election to inform people, let them know. It's been widely publicized, and I suspect that they will be hearing more about that. So we've got some time to sort of implement this, to work out some kinks. I'm sure that the legislature is looking at the implementation in some of the other states for perhaps some glitches that they might have missed. They were very careful in constructing this law to avoid any of those unintended consequences. So I don't think it's a problem at all, and I think any problems that may arise, they will become aware of, and they've got plenty of time to go back and fix those little glitches if they need to.
What about that, Bob? We got time to ramp it up. We got time to do a rehearsal here, right? I mean, you leave the J out of my name, and the what the voter person has in front of them doesn't match my ID.
Right.
We'll fix that because 2014 we'll test it.
In 2014, it's less than 6 months away, the primary. So people will be asked, as Becky said, as a member, as part of an education, really, to help people recognize that the ID will be coming down the line. But I'm afraid that once they start asking people, the word on the street will be they're asking for IDs down at the polls. If you think you're going to have a problem, people are going to just stay away. So we're trying to educate people ahead of time that what they've got to do is look to see now, does your registration have the same name as your voter ID if you've got one? And if you don't have one, let's go ahead and get you one now.
Well, that's kind of interesting because in some ways I'm not going to have to get a special ID. I've got a driver's license, right? So I can use that. But interestingly enough, if the name on my driver's license doesn't match the name on their registry,
I think it can cause some confusion.
I have a problem. And I may not know that until.
Right. Now, the language in the statute says it has to reasonably resemble. The name has to reasonably resemble on the two documents. And the judges will review that. All of them have to agree that if it doesn't. So that's good that they have it that way.
So wait a minute, let me just get this. I'm going to get a picture here. I go, I show my name. The person who I show it to says, you're Frank J. And that says, Frank, you're not the right person. I bring out, there are three people there.
Mm-hmm.
They're judges.
Right.
And they're going to make a decision. And if all three of them say, no, this is not a match, then I have to go home. But if any one of them says, look, that's close enough, then I vote.
Correct. That's
right. So there's sort of a safety net there, if you will.
We want to keep that in there, and I hope it doesn't, they don't turn it into a majority where you could have two Republicans, one Democrat, or two Democrats, one Republican, vice versa, kind of picking on each other.
Yeah, there's no indication that that would happen. I think the law, again, was crafted to clear up some of those
things. The student
ID
is a big problem, that they have not allowed a student, any even government, university student ID. Most other states that require photo IDs, even government photo IDs, allow a student. The ones that they modeled this one on.
And it's more than voter ID, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. Tell us more about it.
Oh,
yeah. It's a much more expansive bill. It started in the House as just an ID bill, but it went over to the Senate. And after the Supreme Court ruled on the Voting Rights Act and it kind of essentially gutted the preclearance requirement that would look at it from the standpoint of racial discrimination, then the Senate loaded it up with all kinds of other provisions, cutting back early voting, eliminating same-day registration, eliminating out-of-precinct voting, eliminating straight ticket voting, which we've had for generations, getting rid of the teenage pre-registration, allowing teenagers to the whole provision for even stand by your ad, a lot of things around campaign finance, increasing the contribution limits, allowing more corporate money into the parties. So it was 40 other provisions that they added in. And I think a lot of those on the voting side will be provisions that hurt people.
Well, let's talk about those, Becky, because those really do not address voter integrity, the integrity of the voting system, of shrinking the amount of time you have to vote ahead of Election Day. Pre-registration for teenagers, those kinds of things.
Right. And none of those things are constitutional rights either. These are sort of process things, if you will. And all of the things that Bob mentioned, and you're exactly right, this was a very large bill that went in and did a lot of different things. But just about every one of those things that Bob mentioned actually bring North Carolina more in line with other states. We were in the minority in a lot of the things that we required. For example, straight ticket voting. Only 14 states allow straight ticket voting. North Carolina now joins 36 other states. Same-day registration. Only Ohio and North Carolina allowed same-day registration during early voting. So, again, this brings us more in line with the rest of the country. So I don't see any of these provisions. It was a big bill. It did a lot of things. But when you look at the individual pieces of this and the changes that were made, none of this is sweeping. None of this is out of line with what other states do. And as a matter of fact, as we reviewed all of these in the law in its entirety, North Carolina still has some of the most liberal voting regulations than other states do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but shouldn't they? I mean, and the idea is whether or not you're in line with other states, they made it easier to vote and they didn't attack the integrity of the system. So why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you be out in front of the rest of the states and be a model state for encouraging voter participation?
Well, I'm not sure that some of these things necessarily encourage voter participation. You know, when the Democrats were in charge of North Carolina politics for 140 years, they drew up all these regulations. Now that the Republicans are in charge, they're changing some of those. And so the reaction from the left has been, oh, my gosh, this is suppressing the vote. From the people on the right, the people that have constructed this law, they believe that this brings integrity and some accountability into the voting. And with that, I think the whole purpose, they said during the debate at least, was the intent of this is to restore integrity to our voting system so that voters have confidence when they go to the polls.
What about that, Bob?
Well, there are three things I'll say. One is that we have a very long history of manipulating the voting rules, that's for sure. And North Carolina was in the bottom 12 states for voter turnout for the entire 20th century, coming out of the Jim Crow, out of the Reconstruction, out of the KKK and so on. People were pushed away from the polls. And it's been a very gradual process to get better rules, better regulations, more access, to change that message that voting is not for you. It's only for the boss man. And we, as an advocate, we had to push the Democrats to get same-day registration. That was a big reform, and it did impact a lot of people. Early voting helps a huge number of people vote who on weekends who work on Tuesdays. So these are really provisions that have added access. North Carolina went from that bottom 12. We were in the top 12 in 2012. There have been real reforms that have helped access for Democrats and Republicans, black and white. They've disproportionately been used by African Americans, all of these provisions. To talk about the integrity, The irony here is that the one provision that they did expand access to is the absentee ballot, the mail-in absentee ballot. Now, that if you ask any expert, left, right, middle, they'll tell you the preferred method of cheating in elections is the mail-in absentee ballot. But it is the method that is used more by Republicans than by Democrats. So that is, it turns out, you know, as they cherry-picked these provisions, African Americans are 22% of registered voters. They're 34% of the same day users of same day. So they went after that. But they're only 9% of those who use the mail-in ballot. They leave that alone. They expand access to mail-in.
Yeah, talk about that. I couldn't even get the governor to answer this question. There is evidence of fraud being more widespread in absentee balloting than on same day false ID. So if you know that and the evidence is available to you and restoring integrity is your goal, then you would tighten the restrictions. But instead they were loosened. And what is demonstrable is that absentee voting favors Republicans. More absentee votes go to Republicans. That does seem suspicious.
Well, it expands access with additional absentee ballot. And help me with this, Bob. You may have looked at the law more carefully than I did, but I recall that there was at least discussion of requiring an additional signature or some measures put in place with the absentee ballots. I know there was some discussion right. of having those absentee ballots notarized. I think what they ended up with was that there was an additional witness signature that was assigned to it. So while they extended that access through absentee balloting, they also shored up the integrity of those absentee ballots.
Well, they did add a witness, which goes back to what we had previously. But you'll see what's going to happen, Frank, is there a lot of interest groups on the left, the right, and the middle. Both parties will start to use mass mailing of applications out to people. So we'll actually see an increase in the mail-in absentee because previously you couldn't do that. But there'll be a mailing out of applications, and they'll pre-populate those forms with your name and your address. And they'll tell you, Frank, all you got to do is just put in your birth date, the last four of your social, and drop it in the mail. And we've paid the postage for you, and you'll get a ballot. And, you know, now that it's just going to proliferate, and we'll have organizations doing it in basements and in, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean,
we'll probably have organizations from both sides of the
absolutely.
Aisle. So when you change the rules and there's more, you know, we hear the complaints about less access, prohibiting access to voters. If this movement will increase access for voters, then isn't that where we want to go?
Yeah, but again, you know, we start off with improving the restoring integrity as the goal. And then when we get to absentee, we hear about improving access. So why not improve access which is the goal? And of course, you want a program, a system with integrity that has great access. So why would you restrict access on the one hand, limit early voting, make it harder for students to vote, make it harder for pre-students, and then only increase the access for absentee? Which goal is it?
Well, I would argue a little bit with the premise of the question. You know, you are assuming that requiring a photo ID, a driver's license, state-issued ID, somehow prohibits or discourages students from voting.
No, not the voter ID part, but the fact that students now have to vote. They have to go home to vote. They can't vote from their school. They used to be able to do that. If you limit the number of days where we can early voting, limit pre-registration for teenagers. I mean, all those things restrict access, not the voter ID part. That's open to question. All those other things really do limit access, less time to vote, less time to register, all of that stuff. I mean, why wouldn't you expand it all, absentee, and then in some ways use voter ID to maintain integrity or restrict integrity?
Well, I don't know how to answer that. I mean, that was a decision that was made by the General Assembly. But just a couple things. You know, the amount of time for early voting has not decreased. It is the same number of hours as it was in 2010 and 2012. So this notion that somehow the restriction of early voting has come about, it's fewer days. The window is fewer days, but the number of hours is the same. As far as, you know, pre-registering 16 and 17-year-olds, they can't vote. So I'm not sure how that restricts their ability to vote. They can't vote. And also only five states allowed 16, 17-year-olds to register. So some of these things, it's just sort of cleaning up the system, I think, if you will.
Well, it improves access. I mean, again, it's how you sort of frame the problem. If you want to improve access, right, by making it easier to vote absentee, then wouldn't you want to improve access by getting kids registered in high school? They can do it in their classroom.
Well, that's when they go to the DMV when they're 16. And so why not sign them up there in front of an official? And when you get their name spelled right, you know, instead of on the street when people are filling out these forms. And it is a better process.
Now, and of course, the main claim, the substantive claim here behind all of this is that it's fundamentally racist, that as Bob pointed out, African Americans have benefited by changes in the laws over time. We've seen very little voter fraud. There was, when you talk about restoring integrity, it hadn't been breached in any substantial way. So then you think, well, if African Americans benefited by changes in the law that hadn't harmed integrity, then making it more restrictive appears to be racist. And of course, then leave it to The Daily Show to find Don Yelton, a GOP precinct chair in Buncombe County, who has since resigned and I think was more or less forced to resign after this appearance on The Daily Show.
Let me tell you something. You don't look like me. But I think I've treated you the same as I would anybody else.
Right.
Matter of fact, one of my best friends is black.
So one of your best friends?
One of my best friends.
Is black?
Yes.
And there's more.
When I was a young man, you didn't call a black, you called him a Negro. I had a picture one time of Obama sitting on a stump as a witch doctor, and I posted that on Facebook. I was making fun of my white half of Obama, not the black half. And now you have a black person using the term nigger this, nigger that, and it's okay for them to do it.
You know that we can hear you, right?
All right. This guy resigned. I don't think he represents the mainstream of the Republican Party in any way. However, there is something in that when we get to this question of is this fundamentally racist, his heartfelt belief that showing Barack Obama as a witch doctor wasn't racist. It was him. Is there something sort of subtly that you know, the folks who changed this law didn't understand how racist, whether they intended it or not, because of the impact it has on African-Americans, has a very racialized impact. And they just don't understand in the same way that poor old Don doesn't get that Barack Obama, like a witch doctor, is racist.
Well, I think, you know, we need to make it clear. I mean, Don Yelton speaks only for himself, and I think his comments were ill-conceived and unfortunate. As far as how
and
this applies to—
I should say that the John Locke Foundation had one of their kind of stringers did something with that witch doctor stuff, and they got rid of that person. They said, no, this is out— over the top, out of the league. We do not want to be associated with that. And this is the John Locke Foundation, so it's you're right. It's not part of the mainstream. I don't think it's part of the mainstream. I think you're right about the passion that is around this whole issue is racialized. It is because black folks don't understand how white people feel so threatened, so monumentally threatened by having a black man in the White House, and white people don't understand why white people don't understand that we have seen this before. We know what you're doing. We know exactly that you're after us. There's no way you can tell us you're not after us. So both sides have a perception, and there's some, you know, real basis in these things. There's a cultural war that we're involved in now, and bridging the gulf and being able to talk straight with people is tough.
Well, bridging that gap is tough. Bob and I were talking before the show about the emotions that are tied up in this whole thing, and I think that the media and outside groups have really perpetuated that and that perception in many ways. As far as the intent of this election law, the thing that I think is important to remember is that all of these provisions are implemented across the board to every voter, regardless of age, sex, race, anything else. And as long as those laws are implemented fairly and evenly across the entire voting population, and I don't think that there is any indication that any of these provisions are done differently than that, then I don't see where it is unfair to any group.
We will see. Thank you both for being on the program. Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at the John Locke Foundation. Bob Hall, Executive Director of Democracy North Carolina. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Just ahead, the music of Hot at Nights. Stay tuned.